thing. Housekeeping, House Bill 2684 will not be heard today. It's been rescheduled for next Monday. And with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on HJM 4. Sandy.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. House Joint Memorial 4 is urging Congress to enact financially sustainable, voluntary, universal, and privately administered outpatient prescription drug coverage as part of the federal Medicare program.
What a concept. Jim. It's a memorial. Tell them that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm appearing today for the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. As you and I have discussed, Mr. Chair, often these memorials to Congress are kind of viewed as fruitless efforts, let's say. The legislature sends them out, and Congress presumably receives them somewhere and files them away. However, I would submit to you that in this particular circumstance, given the dire straits that the state of Oregon is in, given the fact that our inability to serve all the people that need to be served with prescription drugs has made the front page of the New York Times and other national publications, in this particular case, this memorial might actually have some impact in terms of moving the debate forward. So I would commend it to your attention and urge you a yes vote.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. That was the only one signed up to testify. I'm going to close the public hearing on HJM 4, and I'm going to open a work session on HJM 4. And I would entertain a motion.
So moved.
Representative Anderson moves HJM 4 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am hearing nothing but cries of help from, as I'm sure each one of you are, and I think that as soon as possible, if the Congress can move to give us help, is the earliest time I'd like to see it.
It's true, and I guess the chair would echo that and say that Congress has played with this thing long enough, and this may not have the force of law, but maybe they just need a few things to start the ball rolling. And you know, we've been waiting for this ever since I've been in the building.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Tomei.
Have any other states sent this resolution?
I don't know.
Okay.
But we are.
I can understand that.
Okay.
49 others and 6 territories.
Okay. Any other discussion? Hearing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Barker.
Excused.
Representative Dalton.
Aye.
Representative Monica Anderson.
Excused.
Representative
Tomei. Aye.
Representative Weston.
Aye.
Chair.
Aye. House Joint Memorial 4, having received the required majority, is declared passed, and the chair will carry. We will not put this on the consent calendar. So we need stuff on the record. So
I'd be glad to carry it if you'd like me to.
No, I said I would. But I would welcome everybody to speak to it.
Sure.
I think this is something that should be a high level of interest to all members of the body. With that, I will close the work session on HJM 4 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2374. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2374 requires the Department of Human Services to reimburse specific rural health clinics for prescribing and dispensing prescription drugs. It requires the health insurance coverage for prescription drugs dispensed at certain rural health clinics, and it declares an emergency. Attached to your packet, you have the -1 amendments and a Haney and Gross version of those amendments, which the presenters will speak to.
Okay. Bruce Carlson and Ed, you coming with him?
Well, I think I should testify last.
You want to testify last? Okay. Well, you should have signed up last. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Bruce Carlson. I'm both a family physician and a registered pharmacist. I spent over 30 years of my medical career in rural communities in eastern Oregon. and before I went to medical school, I practiced pharmacy in Eastern Oregon. I'm a member and former chairman of the Rural Health Coordinating Council, which is the advisory body to the Oregon Office of Rural Health. I'm also a board member of the Oregon Rural Health Association. And I also serve on the Physician Assisting Committee of the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners. Over the last 20 years, I've worked with six rural clinics in communities under 1,000 population. With the exception of one community, there was no community pharmacy available in these communities. I presently have two rural clinics. In one case, the nearest pharmacy is 63 miles away. And in the other case, the local pharmacy does not accept Oregon Health Plan prescriptions. The nearest pharmacy that does is 63 miles away. In fact, there are many rural communities in Oregon where medical clinics exist with no local pharmacy or there is limited access to prescription medication. According to the Office of Rural Health, at least 15 have been identified where there is no pharmacy. This requires residents to travel great distances to obtain urgently needed medication. This is especially burdensome for the elderly and for recipients of the Department of Human Resource Program. Both of these groups are often transportation impaired. That is, in essence, the problem. I see this bill as part of the solution, which will require the Department of Human Resources and health insurance companies to reimburse rural clinics for urgent outpatient medications when there is no pharmacy available. As far as fiscal impact of this, the state of Oregon and insurance companies should not experience any additional cost. In fact, there may be a savings due to a decrease in emergency room usage, and the department may realize another cost savings by not having to reimburse recipients for the cost of travel to another community to obtain prescription medicine. I've been informed that there's been several instances where the Department of Human Resources has reimbursed Oregon Health Plan recipients to travel to include meals to another community to pick up drugs. I would like to offer an amendment. The original bill just stated 15 miles, but in talking with one of the clinics, we became aware that if they saw somebody on a Sunday when the local pharmacy was closed and the pharmacist was out of town, that maybe for this child with an ear infection, they would have to find the medicine to dispense, and this would enable situations like that. Also, there are cases where the local pharmacy does not accept prescriptions for Oregon Health Plan recipients. I thank you for your time and consideration and for the support of House Bill 2374.
Questions? Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you tell me how wide a formulary you're talking about? How many 15 drugs, 7,500?
This would depend on the clinic for them to stock the medicines. Usually this involves about 20 different medications.
That's sort of doable.
Yes.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you describe Legend Drug in Section 1? It does describe it. Could you do that more thoroughly for us, please?
The legend refers to the federal statement. It says federal law dispenses prohibits dispensing without prescription. And a bottle of prescription medicine comes from the manufacturer of the pharmacy with that statement on it, and that's called the legend.
So it's not follow up, thank you. Any drug that requires a prescription is a legend drug, is that what you're saying?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
In spite of Representative Westland's concerns earlier, I would like Lynn Reed to come up.
Oh, my God. Wait, we've got quorum. I can leave.
Good morning, Lynn.
I don't know why you
chair members
this, Lynn.
Of the committee. It's nice to see you again.
It's been way too long.
I'm Lynn Reed, administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs in the Department of Human Services. And I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2374. which does require the department to reimburse rural health clinics for prescription drugs for acute medical conditions, which I understand the intent to be for urgent medical situations, if there is no pharmacy within 15 miles of that clinic. This will improve access for clients in rural areas, which we very much support. I just want to mention, though, that there are currently three avenues available to rural health clinics where they could dispense those drugs. One is the clinic could become a certified drug manufacturer, which basically just allows for the repackaging of drugs, and then they could dispense and bill for those drugs. But they would have to meet all the pharmacy requirements and pay a $400 fee for the certificate. They could also contract out with a repackaging service for the drugs. In addition, the physician, if there's a physician in the clinic, can apply for a physician dispensing license. This bill will add some administrative oversight to the role of the department. It'll be necessary for us to make sure the clinic is in compliance with some federal regulations related to prospective and retrospective drug utilization review, and that prescription counseling is available for clients. To the degree these are patients of the clinic, generally you would expect that would be going on in any case. We have to make sure under federal regulations that a rural health clinic would not bill us for a visit that was for the sole purpose of dispensing the prescription drug. But we could pay for the drug, and of course if an individual were there for an office visit, we would pay for that visit for that purpose. In order to testify in support of the bill, it needs to have no cost that isn't already assumed in the governor's balanced budget. And so my testimony assumes that the rural health clinic would use an electronic point of sale system, which may or may not be feasible because there is a significant cost to the clinic for purchasing such a system, although we were talking in the hall about the potential that there could be some grant monies to do that. If the clinic did not use the point of sale system, it would be necessary for us to bring on board some staff that would have to do the manual pricing when claims came in. We have over 100,000 drugs in a complex system that's in the computer in terms of pricing, and that activity would need to occur as well as data entry of paper claims. So our assumption is that indeed there would be an electronic billing of the claim. I just want to say that we are researching various ways in which to improve access in rural communities as well as other areas, working with community partners that not only include rural health clinics, but federally qualified health centers and tribal clinics, working with the Board of Pharmacy and with the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. With that, it's a good bill. Thank you.
Questions?
Just comment, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
An explanation of all this good-natured hazing. Lynn Reed, Tom Holt, John Powell, Jim Gardner, who else is out there? We've all been working every night on the Oregon Health Plan, and so we've been seeing more of each other than we have of our husbands or wives. And you know, my private life is my own affair. The legislators involved, you know, then Lynn and her entire staff has to go back and crunch all the numbers that for the questions that we all gin up for them. So, thank you.
You're welcome.
They have really been working overtime.
And that, before you leave, I've got about 30 more questions.
Yeah. So we really scheduled this hearing this morning. It was just we didn't want to call.
And we don't need the answers till Monday. So
no problem.
Thank you very much. Peggy, you ready? Okay. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I represent the Health Insurance Association of America. The reason the chair asked me if I was ready was that I said I had to go down and make some copies of my testimony. And typically enough, I had operator error and had to recollate the stuff before I had to come back up here. But in any event, I'm here to testify with regard to some concerns I have with regard to House Bill 2374, and specifically the concern that I've got relates to the mandatory reimbursement requirements for commercial health insurance provided to employers and individuals in terms of this bill. The first issue is a process question, and that is that my reading of this proposal is that it constitutes a new health insurance mandate under ORS 171.870, and I've included a copy of that. And under those provisions, there are analyses required to address a variety of questions that range from what's the cost benefit, what is the need for the service, et cetera. And I would say with regard to this proposal, I understand that it's an access discussion. I would say that with in the private commercial market, we've had over the last few sessions a number of patient protection measures that have specifically considered access issues. And there's processes that carriers are obligated to comply with to assure that adequate access is provided to providers and other kinds of services that are covered. So there is perhaps an issue, but at least I would say that with regard to commercial private insurance coverage, the access issue is being addressed under a separate set of statutes. The other concern I have is a substantive one related to the way the language in Section 4, which gets into the health insurance requirements, is written. It is not clear to me that an insurance plan could utilize its own formulary or exclusions. It essentially says that the health insurance policy will reimburse those prescriptions that are given out in these specific circumstances. There is another issue in there, too, and that is I'm not sure that the copayment provisions and other policy provisions that relate to prescription drugs would continue to apply as presently in a number of health insurance policies. And that is the reason, because they have oftentimes separate kinds of copay structures, three-tiered copay structure for brand generic and a particular kind of brand are often specified. These are separate and distinct from the copay provisions that often apply to your other basic benefit plans. It's not clear the way the statute is written or this proposal is written that those provisions would allow to be continued. And finally, the issue that I wanted to bring to your attention is in with the mandates issues overall, and many of you have heard me periodically discuss before Representative Westland's committee in the audit, the concerns over the private health insurance market. And there is a table that I've attached at the end of my testimony that actually shows what we're talking about in terms of who is affected in terms of insurance mandates. And what these data are based upon reports provided to the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And what you see is that you have an ever diminishing number of folks subject to the insurance code in Oregon. In people who buy individual policies, and I would rank these in terms of those folks that are most price sensitive, there's only 171,000 individual policies written in Oregon, and that's out of a population of about 3.4, 3.5 million. We're also seeing a decline in the small employer market. The large market, the large employer groups, the significant thing is there is that these are the folks that have the opportunity to self-insure. And the more regulated this group becomes and the more mandates that they look at, the more inclined they are to opt out of the portion of the insurance code that the state can regulate. And, in fact, in the data that I'm showing, there were recently three groups with 50,000 insureds that moved into a self-insured status. And the general attitude is that they like to have more control over their own destiny. I would probably debate with them as to how much greater control they have over their base claims cost, but it is true they have greater control over their plan designs and what they're subjected to. Anyway, I have, like I said, both process questions with regard to this bill, and then I would also have, if the bill were to proceed, technical questions or concerns about the way the section is written as it applies to the insurance code. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Tom Holt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. Pleasure to be in a meeting with you during the daylight hours.
We want pizza.
So that's what you look like.
I just want to briefly express our support for this bill. It is an access issue in the rural areas of our state. Ordinarily, though, just to clarify where we are in terms of others doing the dispensing function, the reason we're able to support this, whereas we're going to have some issues with some of the other bills that may come through the body having to do with dispensing, is that, one, we're dealing with a relatively small number of prepackaged items. So we're not really talking about the whole universe of drugs. It's also pretty clear that the proponents of the measure intend to have the appropriate information systems standing behind them in the dispensing process. So, we have had some discussion with some of our rural providers, and the Board of Pharmacy has weighed in. They're okay with it. So we don't see any real safety issues of significance with this bill. So with that, we'd like to see the bill go through with the amendments that have been proposed.
Questions? Representative Anderson.
I probably should have asked this of Lynn, but what's involved in getting a physician's dispensing license? Is that pretty simple? Do most physicians have it?
Chair Cruz, Representative Anderson, I don't think most physicians have those licenses, but it's a license available through the Board of Medical Examiners.
Simple to get.
My understanding is it's a fairly easy process.
Any other questions? Thank you, Tom. Karen? Good morning,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Whitaker. I'm the director of the Office of Rural Health at Oregon Health and Science University. And I just wanted to make a brief statement this morning in favor of House Bill 2374. The Rural Health Coordinating Council, that is the governor-appointed advisory group to our office, has endorsed the bill, as well as the board of the Oregon Rural Health Association. I wanted to convey their support to you. And I also wanted to give you some information on the numbers of clinics that might be affected. I've attached to my testimony a map that shows you where the rural health clinics are in the state. And I think there are also federally qualified health centers there, so notice the legend is different for each. And then the numbers of rural health clinics. Yesterday I sat down and did a cross-reference between the licensed pharmacists in the state and the rural health clinics, and found only 6 communities where there were no licensed pharmacists at all that were more than 15 miles away from another place where there might be a pharmacy. If you add in those that have limited hours and so on, as Dr. Carlson indicated, you might go up to maybe 15. It seems unlikely to me that employers would be motivated to self-insure over the impact of just 6 to 15 clinics. So I'm just hoping that you will realize this doesn't have a very significant impact. It's just a small number of clinics that would be affected. And if people have insurance coverage anyway, the prescription drugs will be paid for anyway in some shape or form, so it really won't increase the cost to the insurer or, of course, to OMAP. And I thank Lynn for the support of the Oregon Medical Assistance Program as well. I don't think I have anything else to add to what other people have said, but I would sure be happy to answer questions.
Any questions?
No. Okay, thanks
very much.
Thank you very much.
Edward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Ed Patterson, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Rural Health Association. And our organization that I represent is very supportive of this measure. Just a couple of comments. I want you to be aware that this morning, the first I heard that there may be some insurance opposition to this. And I would echo the comments that Karen just made, that there's not going to be any additional cost to the insurance companies if it's covered, as the bill already states, that if the drug benefits are in the plan, then they're going to be paid by the plan. So, Mr. Chair, I would urge the committee to adopt the amendments. I think if there are some difficulties, that we can work those difficulties out. And my association would like to see you pass the bill out, and we'll meet with the insurers and see if we can rectify whatever wording changes are necessary and make some amendments over in the Senate.
Any questions?
Yeah. Representative Cruz, what would happen if this bill was restricted to OMAP and private providers, private insurance was excluded from the bill?
That would be an option, Representative Westland, and that we certainly would consider if we thought the problem was so great that it had to kind of needed to take place. But we need to have that discussion.
And I guess it's not going to be the desire of this chair anytime during this session to pass a bill to be fixed in the Senate. Simply because of the makeup of the Senate. Well, and I'll let it go at that, I think. But
yeah, keep going.
Okay, if I could retract all that, what I would say was that Senator Fisher and I have had an agreement over the years not to send each other unfinished bills. So I think what I would like to do, committee, with this bill is to have Ed and Peggy and whoever else needs to be on the table sit down and make sure that concerns are addressed, and then we'll bring this back. I do intend on moving this bill, but I'd like to make sure that concerns are adequately addressed before we do.
Mr. Chair, we'll be happy to follow your lead. I just thought I'd ask.
Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, you didn't answer my question.
He said, yeah, he did, actually.
He just said that was an option. He didn't tell me what would happen. Well, that's okay. Sure. We'll let you work it out and report back to us.
Okay. Thank you, everybody, and we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2374. It will come back when all the bugs are worked out. And I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2558. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2558 is requesting that the Drug Use Review Board, in interviewing retrospectively and prospectively the drug use, may only consider drugs that have received final Federal Food and Drug Administration approval.
Okay. Jim, do you and Paul and Don want to all come together?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm again representing Pharma today in support of House Bill 2558. House Bill 2558 is a very simple bill that does one simple thing. It prohibits the Oregon Drug Use Review Board from conducting retrospective or prospective reviews of prescription drugs that have not yet been approved by the Federal Food and Drug Administration. We call this, for shorthand, the No DUR Before It's Time bill. Why is this bill important? Because on at least one occasion in the past, the Oregon Drug Use Review Board, the DUR board, attempted to preemptively list a certain drug as not covered under the Oregon Health Plan before that drug had even received final approval from the FDA. Passage of this bill would prevent such preemptive strikes against drugs in the FDA pipeline. Now, let me hasten to add that PhRMA is an extremely strong supporter of both the prospective and retrospective drug utilization review process. Careful, well-informed DUR helps ensure, first, that the right drugs are being prescribed to treat the conditions of patients on the Oregon Health Plan, and second, and very important, that only conditions above the line are being covered by the plan. Indeed, the legislation which codified the entire DUR process in Oregon in 1993 was our bill, and it's codified essentially verbatim into the statutes. So we're big supporters of DUR. But the DUR process is deliberately designed to evolve with ongoing medical research and clinical evidence of patient and provider experience with respect to FDA-approved drugs. The process was never intended to preemptively preclude the use of pending new drugs before they had even been approved by the FDA. And I would suggest to you that such an approach, such preclusion, is antithetical, totally inconsistent with the basic philosophy of the Oregon Health Plan, which is that one of the key factors to be weighed in assigning a rank to a particular condition treatment pair on the OHP priority list is the treatability of the condition. And the basic idea is that completely untreatable conditions should rank low on the list. It's a perverse kind of catch-22 argument to contend that a particular drug should be deemed not covered because the condition it treats is currently below the line before a determination can be made about whether the very existence of a potent new treatment, a new drug or some other treatment modality, might push that condition above the line on the ground that it has now become treatable. So we urge your support for House Bill 2558.
Questions?
Yes.
Yeah, let's send it to me.
All of this, thanks, Jim. Thank you, Mr. Chair. All of this is totally new to me. So can you bring me up to speed on what happened to bring this bill up?
Yes, there's a story behind every bill,
right.
And there's a story behind this bill, and with your permission, Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I'd like that story to be told by Don Stetcher, whose drug it was.
Great.
Thank you.
You know, I have quickly prepared testimony because I was on a plane at 4 o'clock in the morning, got in from Novartis, where this story begins 12 to 15 years ago, as a gleam in the eye of the researcher back in at Novartis headquarters. And it also costs approximately $800 million plus for any of our drugs to actually come to market. It takes 12 to 15 years to come to market. And there is a very rigorous, robust, and I might add very expensive process and scrutiny that the FDA does for each of the drugs, which at times seems to us excessive and onerous, but actually allows for all of us to have confidence in the drugs that we consume that eventually do actually come to market. And so,
Don,
I guess the thinking is...
Could you give us your name, please?
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Don Stetcher with Novartis Pharma.
Thank you very much. Continue.
I apologize. And it is reasonable to expect that, to allow the process that the FDA has set up to take place and to have all of the facts before you come out with an opinion on whether or not a drug should be covered by the Oregon Health Plan. And we had a drug that was, in fact, at that point in time, and this would have been about 3 years ago, called Zelmac. It has even changed names before it came to market. And the people at the DUR in Oregon had already decided that it was not worthy of coverage before it even came to market. And it eventually came out in, and the name was Zelnorm, which it is now, and it's helping a lot of folks that have irritable bowel syndrome. So does that answer your question?
So are you, if I may, Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. So are you telling me that the Oregon DUR now has decided that it is an appropriate drug?
They have not decided that. It is still not covered. In fact, Oregon is the only state in the country that does not have Zelnorm available for its Oregon Health Plan Medicaid patients.
follow?
Mm-hmm.
So as I understand your argument here, it's that before the drug passed the DUR, it was deemed by the before it passed FDA.
Exactly.
Okay. That it was determined by the Oregon DUR that it was an inappropriate drug.
That it would not be covered by the Oregon Health Plan.
Okay, okay. And they maintained that even though, I mean, that happened 3 years ago, and they still have maintained that position at this point? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. No, it is not a covered item under the Oregon Health Plan.
So they did not change their position?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may add, and this bill would not preclude, would not order that drug to be covered now. What this bill is, this is a procedural bill, and it basically says that the DUR process shouldn't start before the drug is actually approved, before it's gone through the FDA pipeline. You shouldn't have preemptive strikes, essentially. Once it's gone through the FDA pipeline, that's a total, this bill doesn't apply. That's a totally different matter.
Will we be having anyone from the DUR or anybody who has the history of why that happened speaking today?
We don't have anybody scheduled. I don't know, Lynn, you probably aren't in a position to speak to this, are you?
No, I wasn't aware of this particular situation.
Okay, so if I can ask a follow-up question then, mm-hmm. These gentlemen, thank you. So tell me then, what precipitated that? Why did the Oregon DUR do this before it had gone through that process?
And maybe just follow, I mean, and only do it one time and not having done it previously and not having done it since.
If I could respond to that, Chair Cruz, Representative Westland, Representative Tomei, to answer all of your questions, it actually has done a couple of other drugs in the same manner, and I believe those are the flu, the drugs that are used for the flu virus. And but they have done it other than this drug. And again, this is not about one particular drug. This is about the future. That's ancient history, but it is what's precipitated the bill.
But why? I guess my question is, why did they do that before the drug had gone through?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, because the condition at that point, irritable bowel syndrome, mm-hmm. was just on the cusp of the line. It was just a few notches below the cutoff point on the prioritization line. And when you preemptively preclude the use of a new technology, a new drug, you make it impossible to evaluate in a kind of real life situation whether or not that condition has now become treatable because of the existence of that new treatment. You foreclose that whole dialogue, and that's our basic point about why this is not a good idea.
Follow up.
Yeah.
Thank you. I can understand your reasoning, Jim. I guess I'm trying to understand what the reasoning of the DUR was at the time, and maybe you don't know that.
Representative Tomei, I guess you might have to ask them.
I wouldn't presume to ask anybody to speak for other what's in the minds of other people. Representative Bates.
Yes, so thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for letting me sit in. I really enjoy this committee. Unfortunately, usually I have other committees at the same time. Otherwise, I'd be every day making your life a little more miserable. But thank you.
I haven't seen you since last night.
I know. Spending way too much time together.
This year, the price of our real estate is going down.
There goes the neighborhood. Mr. Chair, I ask a few questions.
Sure, you may.
Jim, as my understanding is that usually when a drug is coming through the pipeline, we know a lot about it. We don't know everything about it, and those things can change as it comes out. And I've seen a few drugs come through that, when they actually got approved, had more restrictions on them. Others had more room to work with them. And I think your point is well taken. I'm not going to ask or try to figure out why the DUR made the decision on this prior to approval, because most of us wait for that approval to evaluate a drug in our own practices. And you're right, it would affect it on the list potentially. The list is set up based on the effectiveness of treatment for a lot of those diseases, as well as how severe the disease itself is. And there have been instances, especially in the cancer field, where diseases of types of cancer that were not treatable before were, because of new medications or new treatments, moved up above the treatment line, specifically because treatment became available. So your point is well taken. And I, like Representative Tomei, I'm having a hard time of tracking why the DOR would not wait for final approval, clear understanding what the drug was allowed to be prescribed for, and the limitations on it also. I don't understand why they would go to that length ahead of time. They've got lots of stuff to review coming out of the pipeline, so I would be supportive of your bill unless there's something I don't see here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, I totally agree with your points. I think it was a simple situation where they said this drug is for treating a condition that's currently below the line, end of discussion. But as you point out, the treatability is itself part of the equation for determining where on the line it would go. I mean, by that reasoning, you would exclude a new cancer treatment or a new for a previously untreatable category of cancer or a previously untreatable category of Alzheimer's. It makes no sense at all.
May I speak to
you? Yes, you may.
I'm Paul Nielsen with Pharmacia Corporation. Also urging support of the bill. And I would just underline Representative Bates' comments about how things can change. And having watched many, many drugs come out over the years, the time before release is a time of negotiation and lots of label maneuvering by the different pharmaceutical companies. There are situations where drugs come out with serious warnings on them that are soon taken away with experience with the drug in clinical practice. An example of that is Prilosec, which came out with a very stern black box warning regarding cancer, and within several months it was found that that was strictly an artifact of clinical lab models, and the drug became one of the most popular drugs prescribed in the world. The opposite happens as well, and we're very aware of that, but we would just urge you to at least let the drug come to market with the full flowering label on it before presumptive judgments are made by Medicaid. Thank you.
Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Tom Holt. Just so you know, Tommy, you don't have to testify on every bill, okay?
I don't plan to.
Okay.
Chair, once again, for the record, Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. We're here in opposition to this bill, which we think is a vast overreaction to what has actually taken place in the DIR board. To clarify for you the actual role of the DIR board, it is purely informational. What the DIR board says or recommends is not a required action on the part of OMAP. OMAP can tell the DIR board to go fly a kite if they want to. It's totally up to OMAP whether they adopt any follow-up rules from a DIR board recommendation. The story behind this bill, I think Don summarized it mostly, but there's an important fact left out here that I think should bear on this. In this case, the DIR board did something that usually we should be happy about with the governmental body. They acted quickly and fairly efficiently. The drug Zelmac, now Zelnorm, was on the verge of FDA approval, but the FDA delayed for a short time its final approval because they had identified some problems with the product, which were actually the very same issues that the DIR board had identified in its report. And its report, in summary, said that there was a limited, if any, clinical benefit to the product. There were potentially significant risks, and therefore the recommendation would be that OMAP not cover it, and also because it's tied to the line. As worded, this bill also would prevent the board from reviewing a group of products that have long been in use but actually have never gone through the FDA approval process that exists today. The most famous example of that is Synthroid, which was an object of some controversy over the last couple of years, and I believe the manufacturer has now agreed to go back through sort of a reapproval process of sorts. But there are some drugs that have been sort of grandfathered into the system. They've been in use for many years. There's not believed to be any problems with them, or they wouldn't still be in use. But if this bill were enacted, the board couldn't look at those. And, you know, given that its function is purely informational, it would seem to me that we want practitioners to, which are the people who are on the DIR board, are physicians and pharmacists. We would want them to be looking at all the information out there and to provide that to OMAP and to make that available to practitioners as they do through their website, so people can make, you know, appropriate decisions on whether or not to use those products. So we would urge you not to restrict the important informational function of the DIR board, as this bill would do. It's an overreaction to a couple of particular situations that happen to adversely affect for a short time a manufacturer or so. And really, at the end of the day, I think the DIR board did the right thing here.
Questions? Thank you, Tom. Committee, my position on this is, number one, I appreciate everybody's testimony, but to say that the DIR board is only advisory, that very well may be, but so was LUBA when it was set up only advisory, but at the current time, Court of Appeals takes their advice almost as a matter of law, and so I know how process works. And this is just a matter of process. And personally, I think it's appropriate, but for the comfort level of the committee, we're going to invite a representative of the DIR board in to talk about it before we move the bill. But I think this is just a matter of process. I think it cleans things up. But I want clearly for both sides to have their day in the sun here. So we will invite somebody from the DIR board to come in and explain their process and take action at that point. So I hope that satisfies everybody. And with that, we'll close public hearing on 2558, excuse me, and open a public hearing on 2642. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2642. Is exempting from statute the requiring insurance coverage of emergency services from the automatic repeal provisions. It clarifies the definition of emergency medical condition, and it has an emergency clause on it. This bill originally came to us as Senate Bill 911 in 1997. It was put on the 6-year review and process, sunset process, and this bill is asking that be removed.
Okay, Jim Anderson and Dr. Tooby, as Representative Westland would say, step up and sign in. I don't know where he got that from. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I am Jim Anderson, here today with the Oregon chapter, the American College of Emergency Physicians, and as you heard, committee staff so eloquently say, the bill has that is presented to you today on the surface is a very simple bill. It is asking for the repeal of a sunset, which was established in 1997 through Senate Bill 911. With me today, Dr. David Tooby would like to address the committee and explain to you the reason for the bill that you see before you.
Good morning, in absentia. Mr. Chair and committee. I'm Dave Tooby. I'm an emergency physician. I practice in Tualatin, Oregon. I was here 6 years ago introducing this legislation because it has a personal impact on everybody with commercial insurance and indeed everybody in the country. Before this law was passed, essentially, when you had what you thought was an emergent condition, you'd go to the emergency department, and if it turned out that the diagnosis was not emergent on final review, then essentially you were billed. And if you didn't call for pre-authorization in many cases, you also received the bill yourself instead of the insurance company paying for it. What this had ended up causing is people waiting before coming back to the emergency department for future life-threatening conditions. What galvanized me, I'd like to share a story with you, what galvanized me to really work on this was many cases, but the one that I remember most clearly was told to me by one of my colleagues that was working in the pediatric emergency department at Emanuel Hospital in Portland. There was a small child who came in near death. This child was resuscitated and sent to the intensive care unit, and when the physician was finished with the resuscitation phase, came and spoke to the father and asked the father, why did you bring your son in so sick? Why did you wait so long? And he said, well, I was here 6 months ago with my baby, who I brought in with extreme pain, and given my complaints and looking at the baby, this department did a workup that ended up with a final diagnosis of colic. What the emergency physicians were doing at that time was trying to rule out a life-threatening condition called intussusception, which is a coiling of the intestines cutting off the blood flow and is mortal if not treated. So it turned out that the baby did not have this condition, final diagnosis colic. The insurance company denied the bill. The father had to pay this bill and nearly bankrupted. So he said, I could not take the chance in the future of choosing between feeding my family or taking care. So I had to wait until he was definitely sick enough that everybody would be convinced that he was sick enough and I wouldn't have to pay but still get care. This is a real story. It happened many times, and for that reason, we felt that it was very important to bring this both federally as well as locally. In 1997, not only was it passed in this state, rightly so, unanimously here, but the president also signed it into federal law, and it is the law of the land to this day for Medicaid patients, Medicare patients, CHAMPIS, which is all your military, all federally insured employees. And in fact, even the ERISA-exempt, the self-insured, as we heard earlier, they have taken it upon themselves. And there's a couple small companies in Portland, one called Nike, the other one Legacy, who realized after this bill was passed for all the other commercially insured patients in the city and in the state, they felt that it would be important to put in their policies, and they did so, because they are exempt from both federal and state coverage or law here. It's worked well. It's been accepted by the insurance companies. It's being followed by DCBS. It needs to be renewed. And I think after 6 years of a trial and no complaints, I think that the sunset provision should be lifted. And it should be, we all that are commercially insured should have the same rights as Medicaid and Medicare and federally insured employees. So I would ask that you continue this law that will help us all and provide access to the emergency department in times of emergencies.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. Jim?
We have nothing further, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Just urge the passage of the bill.
Great. Mannheim? I'm sorry, did I miss something?
No, that's fine. I was going to testify to it, but let Nan come up first.
Oh, no. I'm sorry. I didn't know you wanted to testify.
Nan come first, no problem.
All right. Thank you. Nan and Sean Baird.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Nan Heim, representing the Oregon State Ambulance Association, along with our current president, Sean Baird, who is the co-owner of Woodburn Ambulance. We're here today to support House Bill 2642 and to suggest or to request an amendment that would clarify the inclusion of emergency ambulance service. Our members are private companies as well as public agencies that provide emergency ambulance service throughout much of the state. Sean is typical of our members in that he began as a paramedic and is still works as a paramedic even though he is co-owner of the company. At our meeting yesterday at which this bill was discussed, we were observing that a few years ago, discussions at our meetings always revolved around medical issues, quality of care, EMT training, etc. Today, unfortunately, our discussions start with reimbursement and the growing problem of unreimbursed emergency ambulance care and the impact that this is having on our members and their ability to provide quality care. It's happening on many fronts, the loss, total loss of the state motor vehicle accident fund, Medicare cuts, etc. The issue that Sean is going to explain with this bill is one quite small piece of a very large problem, but we think it's one that you can help us address. Sean.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Mr. Chair, no. My name is Sean Baird. I'm a paramedic and the president of the Oregon State Ambulance Association, and I'm here supporting 2642, which has been helpful to our members and emergency ambulance service providers over the last 6 years, I guess, right? Then the issue that has come up is, unfortunately, a few insurance companies have denied emergency ambulance service claims by referring back to the language of the definition of emergency service that is included in the bill, which is very specific to services provided in an emergency department. Most insurance companies extend the benefit, I think, of recognizing that when a person calls 911 for chest pain and an emergency ambulance is sent, that that's all part of the process of delivering emergency service. Unfortunately for us, there are occasions where the insurance organization will look at it and find a reason to exclude us out of there, and then there is a little bit of wiggle room, I guess, in there. And what we're asking for is to clarify that when a person calls 911 and emergency ambulance and paramedics are sent out, and we get there and we see someone with chest pain or difficulty breathing, we're not in a position to be able to offer them a diagnosis and tell them, oh, this isn't an emergency, you don't need to go. I mean, if a person calls and has those symptoms, we have to take them, we want to take them, they need to get definitive care, and we're a critical piece in that chain of events that happens. And what we're asking for today is, I guess, to just be formally recognized as in the bill as a part of the emergency services that would be covered.
Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Bates. Have you had a good week?
It's been, Mr. Chair, it's been a delightful week. Spending evenings with you and Ben. It's been a wonderful, wonderful experience. I always look backward on and think that could have been doing something else. For the record, Mr. Chair, Alan Bates from Ashland, Oregon. I'm a physician in this position, not a representative. I'm in speaking in favor of 2642, and I'll get into those reasons in a moment. My background as a physician is one of as primary care physician for a large number of people in Southern Oregon. I also spend quite often Friday and Saturday nights as a backup physician at the emergency room at Rogue Valley Hospital and Providence Hospital, so I have a great deal of experience in the emergency rooms and in backing those emergency rooms up, as well as being chief of medicine for 4 years at both institutions, where I reviewed chronically and recurrently ER records. So I have a broad experience in this particular field. The bill we have before us today is one I think is necessary and appropriate, and I'll get to those reasons as we go through this. The proper use of the emergency room is always a thorny problem. Abuses do occur. People come in with sore throats and colds and minor illnesses that really are inappropriate for being seen in the emergency room, and sorting them out is an important process. Especially in this day of increasing numbers of uninsured, it's becoming more and more of a problem for emergency rooms, and people are beginning to think of the emergency room quite often as a place to get primary care. Primary care should be obviously treated in a less expensive and more reasonable fashion. emergency room physicians have to deal with that dilemma on a daily basis, and I think do it in a fairly effective way. Part of that effective way, frankly, is denial by insurance companies for some payments, which I don't necessarily oppose. There are times when it was clear that the patient was there for inappropriate reasons, and that insurance claim should not have been paid. But we're talking about situations where, retrospectively, it's very easy to figure out what was going on. At the time you see the patient and have not yet made the diagnosis and have to go through a workup, then a reasonable layperson would say, yeah, you should have been there. And I think that's what this bill really drives to and helps protect. I'm going to give you an example of something that hopefully will make that very clear to you. About 3 months ago, a 52-year-old woman in Shady Cove, which is an area just outside of Medford, started having chest pain one night. She had no insurance, and she was convinced that it was an upset stomach. Family members asked her to go into the emergency room and be seen, but she kept putting it off, saying, I don't think I really need to go. It's just my stomach. I consider those people to be, you know, to be reasonable people, family members and the woman. That pain went on most of the evening and night. The next morning, she died at home and never went to the emergency room. People have a difficult time deciding when they should be seen and when they should not be seen, and we don't want to put barriers in front of them over what I consider legitimate reasons for going to the emergency room. This bill, I think, has been shown to do that for the last 5 or 6 years, and it should be maintained. And I would respectfully ask that this bill go forward, we drop the sunset, and it become a permanent law. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions? Thank you, Doctor. Oh, excuse me, Representative Anderson.
Dr. Bates, you did mention that in some cases the payment should be refused. What do you do about the patients who come in with the sniffles and, you know, cough? And can those still be rejected under this plan? Or?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, yes, it can. And it's a learning process for both sides. It's a learning process for the patient. It's a learning process at times for the emergency room doctor, too. Most emergency room doctors really don't want to be taking care of that kind of patient, and they really feel it's an abuse of the emergency room, and they really don't want to be taking care of those people. They have a code they can sometimes use in certain areas. That it's sort of a diagnostic code. You can look at them, give them a prescription possibly, or get them back to a primary care physician to take care of it. One of the problems, of course, they face is sometimes these patients have no primary care physician, and being uninsured or being on an underpaid system such as the Oregon Health Plan, they may not have access to primary care, and the ER doctor is in a real dilemma. It does not, I don't believe, open it up, and it shouldn't open it up. That should be what's going on. I have real concerns about our ERs being swamped with people going in for what I consider primary care. But the ER physician has to have an ability to make a diagnosis first and be paid for making that diagnosis before the decision is made not to pay any of the bill. I think what most insurers do is pay a small fee, which would not be much higher than if they'd been in the primary care setting, if it turns out that something of that nature is there. And for the most part, I think that works fairly well. There are exceptional cases, there always will be in a large number of people, but for the most part, it works well. And we can educate the public, and I think the ER physicians should have the tools to do that. This is one of those tools.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Peggy.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Peggy Annett, and I am representing the Health Insurance Association of America. I have the concern that I have over House Bill 2642 does not relate to the reenactment of the emergency room coverage. My concern relates to the deletion of the periodic review of it, and that is even though I know every time these mandates come up for review, the more often the outcome is that the scope of the mandate is expanded in the sense of, for example, in 2642, they now include severe pain, which was not part of the previous definition. And then, as you just previously heard, there's discussion about ambulance services, which I will come back to. And I've had this discussion with the proponents, or with Jimmy Anderson on this. We have at least 24 mandates on the bills now that most people would prefer not to have periodically reviewed. We have at least another couple of dozen that have been introduced this session. My concern is the overall policy we have about how we review these going into them and how we set up the process to review them on a periodic basis to determine whether or not the same rationale applies as did when they were initially adopted. What I'm working on now, and I've discussed this with the chair, is some language that deals with potentially clarifying the review process that is stipulated under 743-700. And that, you know, that is what my concern is. That is what I'm working on. And again, it is not with regard to the substance of the emergency room access component. It has to do with the overall question, policy question, as to how we review mandates on a regular and routine basis, not only in terms of when they are initially adopted, but also as time goes on, to reexamine whether or not circumstances and conditions have changed that warrant some new discussion of what the provisions are. And as I say, that's my general issue. With regard to the ambulance service, and I just had a very brief discussion with Nan Heim, and that generally speaking, ambulance service benefits are a separate part of the contract than emergency room services. And what we've agreed to do is sit down and talk about that to see whether or not there might be more of the sort of technical issues that I sometimes get into, that I often get into, and bring them back to the committee depending upon how we proceed with that. But those are my two comments on the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Okay. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Peggy, I'm surprised, I guess. I thought I was going to be hearing from you about all of the abuses that have happened because of this, and I'm not hearing that from you.
Representative Cruz, Representative Tomei, we know that there are issues, and in fact, when we looked at the expansion of the definition in terms of severe pain, that's definitely subjective. You know, and I don't know how you make that an objective decision. If somebody tells me that I'm in severe pain, what that is for me is probably going to be very different than, you know, for anybody else. And there are federal requirements, and what we relied on this was what is actually a nationally accepted definition of the prudent layperson perception of what an emergency is. And there are those gray areas, and it's one of those things that I think is very difficult to write a statutory definition. There are a couple of things that were actually in play when this bill was first introduced. First and foremost, that there was not sort of a national standard of prudent layperson. But there was as much of an issue as somebody going to a non-participating facility. Say you were in a network, and your network of hospitals included XYZ, and you went to hospital P. And that was one of the key issues if somebody got in there and needed to be stabilized medically before. And we realized that there were these kinds of issues that needed to be addressed, and so we have adapted to that. I should also point out that this bill actually was kind of a companion bill to the first set of patient protection legislation that were enacted, I think, in 1997, if my memory is correct. So we've adapted to this, realize that there's some issues. And as Representative Dr. Bates pointed out, you know, there still are those folks that may still find themselves in a situation where it's deemed that their access to the emergency room was inappropriate. And I think that the committee and Representative Bates is also aware is that as more people lose not only Medicaid but also private insurance, there's probably going to be an even grayer area when people access the emergency room for services that perhaps they should not, you know, they could have gone other to a primary care facility or something like that. But that's a separate issue. I'm only trying to focus on what this bill itself is presenting and say that I've got a general concern about how we're going to handle mandates as they are discussed through the rest of the session.
Thank you, Peggy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson?
I'll pass.
Any other questions? Thank you, Peggy. I think there's some work to do on this. I'm there's gray areas here. So, and I'm not sure that the preemption is necessarily where we wanted to go. So, I'm trusting that folks can talk about the issues. I know, Representative Bates, you have nothing else to do, so this should be easy. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2642 and wish you all a lovely weekend because Monday comes way too soon, and we are adjourned.